We acknowledge that we are on Treaty 6 territory, the gathering grounds of many diverse First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples whose footsteps have marked this land and whose presence continues to enrich our vibrant community. Hello and welcome back to Research Recasted, the Knowledge Mobilization Podcast. I'm Brooklyn Lestrician and I'm here with Natalie Smadis.
Hello everyone.
In today's episode, we are joined by Dr. Albina Perglova. Dr. Albina Perglova is an associate professor at the School of Business, McCune University, and currently a BOG research chair. Her research has been published in leading international journals across different fields and recognized with numerous international awards. Together with researchers locally, nationally, and internationally, she is currently working on several longitudinal research projects funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, Employment and Social Development Canada, and the European Union. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited. You have a big history of research, many different fields. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into research?
Oh, that was a long time ago. So I come from a family of educators, so it was always on the back of my mind that I would become an educator one day. But that didn't necessarily mean that I would enjoy research, because research is only one part of education and being an educator. So I wasn't sure whether or not that would be something that I would enjoy. But when I started doing my PhD, I was totally hooked into it. Mm-hmm. And I just loved doing that part of an educator and an academic job. Back then, my early research was on interactions between consumers and organizations and how technology changes that interaction. And this topic has been one of the undercurrents in my research ever since. I just love doing research and I have continued doing it for a while, about 15 years now.
Wow, that's a long time.
That's very nice. When you were getting your PhD, what did you study?
My PhD is in marketing, but it had a lot of emphasis on small business management and the role of small businesses for the local economy as well. So it was kind of at the intersection of entrepreneurship and marketing. And this is how I got into interdisciplinary research as well, because I could see a lot of links between the different fields within business, and I just wanted to make those links within my research as well, instead of just focusing on one single topic within one single discipline. So I've been doing interdisciplinary research.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. I know in my program, it's really emphasized that we know multiple musical skills. So it's a similar, like, oh, I'm learning about something that composition majors are learning about. I'm learning something that performance majors are learning about. Like, it's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good work.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned kind of in our pre-interview that you like to focus on research that focuses on business and positive social change. Can you explain a little bit about this?
Yeah, for sure. So my research is, broadly speaking, at the intersection of business and society. And as I mentioned before, it is interdisciplinary. So, for instance, within the field of entrepreneurship, I have been looking at what you could characterize as underrepresented in mainstream research entrepreneurs. So women entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, people who would like to make positive change for mm-hmm. their communities. So anything outside of the mainstream big businesses. And within the field of marketing as well, my research has focused on how can we improve consumer well-being. So it is not just about the typical marketing techniques and selling mm-hmm. products or services to consumers. I have always been interested in how can we, as academics, but also as marketers, improve consumer well-being. Mm. So those have been kind of the underlying aspects in my research. Whatever field or whatever topic I tackle, it tends to be with an underlying question of what is the social impact here? What are the positive aspects that we can contribute mm-hmm. to different stakeholders involved in the interactions?
Mm.
That's very interesting, especially for me and you, because coming from like music, or for me, like media, kind of we need to find different ways of making money.
Yep.
Sometimes. And so for we usually start as like artists, as small business owners, and kind of ways to market individual projects and stuff. So yeah, that's good work for us little guys.
It's important for sure.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town, and so the importance of small businesses for the local economy has always been something that has fascinated me, and I've seen firsthand how important it is for just the fabric of the community locally. Mm-hmm. And so when I became a researcher, it was really just a natural extension for me to look at small businesses and how we can help them, and how they contribute to the local economy and good interactions with customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool. We'll probably go into some of your research now. You did research on digital technologies and the internationalization of female-led SMEs. Can you explain a little bit about what this research is?
Yeah, for sure. So research on women entrepreneurs or small business owners has been part of my research program now for about 10 years. As I mentioned before, small businesses have always fascinated me, but it wasn't really until I became a mother when I started thinking, oh, okay, so how do women juggle all of those different tasks that they have once they also become small business owners? And so I jumped into that literature, and I discovered a lot of different challenges, but also a lot of fascinating stories of how women entrepreneurs deal with multiple demands. And and so I started doing research into that aspect, and particularly in how they can grow their enterprises and grow not only locally, but also internationally and spread their impact. And so one of the aspects that has been part of my research since the very beginning is technologies and digital technology. So I decided to look into whether or not technologies can help women entrepreneurs to expand their businesses, and what are the ways that they can do that. Especially because in the literature, there is a lot of tensions in terms of women being underrepresented or potentially facing more challenges in international markets. Mm-hmm. Depending on where they expand, there might be cultural norms that are more challenging for their legitimacy on those international markets, or depending also on the industry in which they operate. Some industries tend to be a little more male-dominated and a little more difficult to enter for small women-led businesses. And so with this research, we found that technology was really helpful, and it was able to give more opportunities to women entrepreneurs to their international growth and more specifically export through different kind of technologies, really, from things as simple as front-end technology, consumer-facing technology that can help better interaction with consumers, better interaction with suppliers internationally, but also back-end information management system technologies that were implemented in the operations of those small businesses were also very useful in terms of consolidating the information and having that big data available to entrepreneurs to make more informed decisions and to expand internationally.
That's exciting.
Yeah. That's super cool.
So you kind of mentioned, I'm just curious, talking about the different difficulties for women who maybe have children and stuff. What were some of the findings regarding that? Or any stories that you particularly had?
I've been having conversations with women entrepreneurs for many years now, and what's fascinating in terms of the challenges is that there's always this tension between my company is like a baby, I need to grow it, but I have my real babies as well.
Yeah.
And so there is this tension and this mom guilt that many of those women have talked to me about. This mom guilt of, oh, I want to spend time with my kids, but I also want to spend time with, you know, my employees and growing my company and making sure that I have that self-fulfillment from the venture that I'm building. And so kind of this psychological guilt that they have to deal with as they grow their businesses, and they have to pick how much time to spend on that versus how much time to be at home. it has been one of the challenges that women entrepreneurs face. Mm-hmm. And this is how I also get into the topic of entrepreneurial well-being, because inevitably these kind of challenges affect you mentally, and then mm-hmm. they affect your health and mm-hmm. well-being, because you deal with these tensions in your head, right?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You did research on kind of women in STEM and STEM students. Recently, I went to a women in STEM kind of like a conference, and I wasn't really aware, not being in one of those programs, the issues that they face being in those programs. So your kind of research regarding entrepreneurship in those fields for women, kind of what does that really look like?
So in the STEM fields, women are underrepresented. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the literature, people refer to this as the leaking pipeline. Mm-hmm. So to begin with, there isn't enough women that enter into STEM education. And even those that do enter into STEM education, as they go through the stages, so they graduate and then they go into STEM jobs, many of them start leaking out of this pipeline, mm-hmm. right? So they start stopping their work in those fields and starting something else. And as time goes on, there is less and less women in those occupations. Mm-hmm. And this is what I was previously kind of just mentioning. Some industries are more male occupied mm-hmm. than others, or male dominated. So STEM is, of course, a classic example of those. We don't have enough women that work in those fields. And so it has become a big public policy issue as well. Mm-hmm. Like, why don't we have more women studying and working in those STEM fields? With this particular research, we looked at entrepreneurship education. Can it help to motivate more women to enter into STEM mm-hmm. fields as mm-hmm. entrepreneurs? We looked at three dependent variables, what we call in research, right? So the dependent variables are the outcomes that we would like to achieve. And this is the perceived feasibility of an entrepreneurial career in STEM, the desirability of this career, mm-hmm. whether or not women find it desirable, and their intentions to start a technology business, right? So can entrepreneurship education help with any one of those, make it appear a more feasible career choice for women, make it a more desirable career choice for women, and ultimately, can it help with their entrepreneurial intentions in that field? Mm-hmm. And this is a particularly important aspect for me as an educator, because mm-hmm. you would hope that education will affect change, mm-hmm. right? But in this particular field, research is quite conflicting. Some research has found that, yes, it can help. And for others, it's like, not necessarily. It depends, because there are many challenges for women in STEM because they're underrepresented. And so learning about all of those challenges and what they need to do as an entrepreneur may motivate them, or it may have the opposite effect of demotivating
might
them.
Maybe too much.
And saying, oh, okay, I'm not sure if I want to do that.
too overwhelming. Yeah,
it might become too overwhelming. And so this is exactly what we wanted to figure out with this research. Would it have a desirable effect on them? I have to mention, this is a study that was done with data in Europe, in Bulgaria in this case, with colleagues there that conducted the data collection. Mm. Findings may or may not be necessarily replicable for the Canadian context or for other contexts. But in this particular case, we found that entrepreneurship education was able to motivate female students, was able to make an entrepreneurial career look more desirable to them mm-hmm. and look more feasible, because they're able to practice some of those key entrepreneurial skills that made it look, oh, okay, I can actually do that. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it. I'm practicing this. So it is becoming a career that is an option now for me. So that was encouraging to see.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know whenever I get my hands on whatever I'm learning, that's usually when I remember it best, or when it really sticks best. So yeah, that's good. That's good.
Hmm. Kind of looking at the results, it said that entrepreneurship education has a stronger impact on feasibility, desirability, and intentions for technology for female STEM students compared to their male counterparts. So does this mean that females are more motivated through entrepreneurship in STEM than males are?
That is a very good question. So what happens is that males are a priori more motivated.
Yeah.
Because it is a career choice that traditionally has been mm-hmm. one of the male choices. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't traditionally been one of the choices for many women. And mm-hmm. depending on the context and the country context, yeah. you know, in some countries it's more difficult than in others mm-hmm. Because of issues such as, you know, access to education or social norms that may position a certain career as more desirable for mm-hmm. women or for men, right? And so in this particular case, men tend to be more predisposed to those careers anyways. So the question is, can then entrepreneurship education be more motivating for women? And that is what we found. The entrepreneurship, particularly participating in an entrepreneurship course, had a higher effect on motivating the female students more. But that's also because they were less motivated to begin with. So education was the one that that really helped them more because, you know, the male students were like, yeah, that's a good choice for me anyways. So maybe for them, that education piece, participating in that entrepreneurship course, wasn't that important in helping motivate them because they were already motivated.
Yeah. We kind of talked about it a little bit before, but I think we're going to go back to it. We're going to talk about your research regarding self-employment and well-being. Can you talk a little bit about self-employment and well-being and how kind of they connect?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, it was a topic that I started being interested in when I looked into the women entrepreneurship literature and I started talking to local women entrepreneurs and that guilt feeling that was affecting their well-being. And so I said, oh, okay, there is something interesting here that I need to look into. But it expanded then beyond just women entrepreneurs to, you know, different kinds of entrepreneurs and how they deal with the tensions that, you know, small business owners, self-employed people have. And the interesting thing is that the literature tells us self-employed people tend to have higher well-being compared to wage employees because they have more job autonomy, because they're able to design their workday the way they want to, and therefore they have more meaningfulness out of the out of that work because they decide what to do and how to do it. And there has been quite a bit of research in that topic recently. It has become a burgeoning area in the entrepreneurship literature, looking at the effects of being self-employed or being an entrepreneur on your well-being. And there seems to be a consensus that in general, overall, self-employed do have higher well-being because of those aspects of I'm my own boss, I have the autonomy of deciding what to do and how to do it. But then when we looked further into it, there's also a lot of stressors for self-employed people. And that's why we kind of looked into the promise of self-employment, but also the limits of self-employment for achieving higher well-being, right? Because it is not all rosy. There are a lot of tensions. There are a lot of stressors. Self-employed people tend to work longer hours compared to wage employees. They have a lot of added tensions that wage employees may not have. And when I looked into the women entrepreneurship literature, the interesting part was that many women enter into self-employment with the idea of having greater flexibility, being able to combine, you know, childcare with work. And yes, there is this aspect, but there is also the aspect of the impact on their health and well-being because they're trying to combine all of those things and put all of that into a normal working day. So there is a positive aspect, but there is also the challenging aspect in terms of being self-employed and achieving a higher well-being.
Is there anything that you found that kind of helps relieve that stress and kind of promotes positive well-being when you're a new business owner or a small business owner?
You know, from my conversations with small business owners, the beginning is always very stressful. Yeah. And you just have to remember that you need to take those breaks and you need to put limits, mm-hmm. And just be conscious of the effect it has on your health, right? Because we want to see those ventures grow. We want to see those small businesses be established. Mm-hmm. And entrepreneurs really are very attached to their businesses. And they are putting a lot of time into them, mm-hmm. and sometimes to the detriment of their own health. Mm-hmm. But in my conversations with entrepreneurs, some strategies that they use is making sure that they have a good network of people that they meet. Interestingly enough, one of the issues that people talk about is loneliness.
Isolation.
Exactly, isolation. You're so much into your business that you forget to go out with friends, mm-hmm. Make space for that relatedness aspect, mm-hmm. in your life. And from the well-being literature, we know that there are three key elements that help to achieve well-being. Relatedness is one of those. Mm-hmm. You should not neglect that. Mm-hmm. Autonomy is the next one, which is why we see entrepreneurs being, you know, happier or having that higher well-being, because they do have that autonomy.
Yeah.
And the autonomy is a very key component of what makes us as human being achieve that well-being,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Being able to employ our skills and our talents is the third one. So that competence dimension, I can develop my competence, I can develop my skills, mm-hmm. And meaningfully employ them in my job. So that's also one of those aspects that entrepreneurs really built with, mm-hmm. their ventures, that competence aspect, yeah. and that meaningfulness. But the one that they may overlook is the relatedness. And it is so important, yeah. for every human being.
Yeah.
And so just don't forget that part, mm-hmm. right? Don't forget that if you overlook it, isolation will kind of get in,
yeah.
And it will affect your well-being.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the food delivery apps and the interplay between justification for use and food well-being. I am a food app user on...
Aren't we all?
Oh, more than I should be, for sure. But what was this research about?
So this research, I have to say, came out of the honors thesis of one of my students, mm? In marketing.
Oh, sweet.
Yes. I love involving students in research. It is one of my passions, and mm-hmm. I just really enjoy doing research with students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to feature one of the works of one of my students.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
I teach marketing, and consumer well-being, as it has become quite clear, is one of my passions in research. And so whenever a student is interested in exploring a topic like this, I jump on the opportunity. And so my student Sabrina was having the issue that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. so many of my friends are addicted to their food delivery apps. And I wonder why. What is happening there? Is there a research in marketing that I can do? And I was like, oh, yeah, there is. Let's dig into this. And so she started having interviews and focus groups with young consumers in terms of, you know, why do you use so much your food delivery app, and what does it give you, and does it help you, and does it help your well-being? Mm. So it was quite fascinating to look into this particular aspect of technology apps, or food delivery apps, mm-hmm. in this case, and to see how it impacts consumers, mm. And more specifically their well-being, or, mm. or food well-being in this case, right?
Yep.
And so what we found with consumers was that it really depends on how you use this app and what do you use your food delivery apps for, how often, under what circumstances. In some cases, it really enhanced their food well-being. And those were the cases when people use it for variety. You know what? I can't cook Indian food because I don't know how to, but I really enjoy it. So I bring variety to my food from that perspective. So every now and then I will order food, and it really helps me. Mm-hmm. Or I'm with friends and we really want to just enjoy each other's company and not think about food. Mm-hmm. Let's just all go and pick something, and it becomes part of that social aspect and mm-hmm. part of that relatedness that we spoke about, right? Mm-hmm. Then it really enhances your well-being. But many people were using it in a way that wasn't really healthy. Mm. Right? They were overusing it, mm-hmm. ordering, you know, junk food all the time. Yeah. Instead of taking advantage of the great variety that you can order yeah. online. Oh, right?
There you go. Yeah.
And
yeah.
and so many nice and healthy options out there mm-hmm. as well, right? But for many people, it was really almost an obsession, almost something that is, oh, I'm just saving time because yeah. I need that time. Are you really saving time? they would get obsessed and they would just look at the app and, where's mm-hmm. my driver? Is my driver yeah. close? Mm-hmm. And they would lose time instead yeah. of saving time just because they were spending time tracking their mm-hmm. driver and where their foot is. And so it was really fascinating to see that it can enhance your well-being, but it can also detract from your well-being yeah. depending on how you use it and for what purposes you use it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it's okay for you to keep using it. Don't feel guilty.
It's
but
too
just
easy.
Be more mindful of yeah. how you use it yeah. and what kind of food you order and for what purposes you use it, right?
It's just,
does it help you with your well-being, or is it just something that it's, oh, I'm just going to do it and then without thinking and without being mindful of what you order and why you order it?
Yeah. Okay, well, do you have anything that you wanted to add?
Well, it's been great talking to you. And there's more research coming out of another student that I'm doing research with, Ashley, and she's looking at senior consumers and their use of technology and well-being.
Interesting.
So look out for that
one.
Yeah,
we'll have to
in
have
case
you, back.
You want to,
we'll have to
talk more about the topic.
Perfect. And then my final question is, do you have any advice for any listeners or any faculty or any students?
I would say research has to connect your head and your heart. Mm. So pick a topic that is really important to you. Pick a topic that will be meaningful to you when you look for research opportunities. Because, yes, research is fun. To me, it is fun. But it is also hard work. It has to be conducted rigorously. And so there will be moments when you'll be like, I have to do this. I have started it, so I must finish it. There will be those moments when it will feel like work, mm-hmm. even though you have fun and you love it. And so it is important that you really are invested in the topic mm-hmm. and pick something that is meaningful to you.
Oh, I like that. That was very nice. Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you for being here today. It was awesome talking to you.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all we have for today's episode of Research Recasted. If you want to support this podcast, you can visit Research Recasted on your favorite podcast platform to find new episodes every 2 weeks. Also, don't forget to check us out on Instagram at Research Recasted, where you can leave us a like, give us a follow, or send us a message if you have any follow-up questions from today's episode. This has been Research Recasted, a knowledge mobilization podcast, brought to you by the Office of Research Services and the Faculty of Fine Arts and Communications at McCune University. Funding for the podcast is partially provided by the Government of Canada through the Research Support Fund. Research Recasted is hosted and produced by Brooklyn Logician and Natalie Smattis. Music, sound design, and editing is by Natalie Smattis. Research, copy editing, and scripting is by Brooklyn Logician. And our executive producer is Hugh McKenzie.